Welcome to the First Things podcast. On this episode, Matthew Walther, associate editor of the Washington Free Beacon, drops by our offices with a bottle of champagne. He'll tell us about his plan for champagne socialism and why fake champagnes, like Barefoot Bubbly, are very, very bad. Then, I'll talk with literary editor Matthew Schmitz about The Power of Silence, the new book from Ignatius Press by Robert Cardinal Seurat. Find out why The Power of Silence has impressed a lot of people, including the Pope Emeritus. I'm associate editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us.
There are, simply put, moments in life that demand champagne. Champagne really should belong to everyone, and it drives me almost to despair to think that people, especially in a country as wealthy as ours, should go without it. That's an excerpt from Champagne for All, a book review by Matthew Walther that appears in a recent issue of First Things. Matthew joins me today to lay out his scheme for champagne socialism and to educate and stimulate our palates. He's brought along a very nice-looking bottle. Matthew, good to have you.
Yes, thank you for having me.
I'm also joined by Matthew Schmitz. So, Matthew Walther, why don't you uncork and introduce your champagne there?
So what we have here, Julia, is the Louis Roederer non-vintage. This is the poor man's Cristal.
Oh, I see.
But if we're going to have champagne socialism, this is what we're going to have to make do with. One of these every month, and on major holidays, feast days, and on the feast days of one's patron saint for every American household, I think, is the program.
I think that seems right. All right, shall we toast?
Yes.
Champagne for all. So Matthew, could you maybe start us off by just telling us a little bit about the characteristics of this particular champagne and why you can recommend it?
I think that what's extraordinary about this and a lot of the other non-vintages that you can get, you know, for $35 or $40 a bottle, is that the champagne difference comes through. It's just so dry and crisp and refreshing when you compare it to some bottle with a really gross name like Barefoot Bubbly that you could find for $15 at Target, which is essentially like Mountain Dew. Like at the chemical level, it's the same thing as Mountain Dew, because they've just taken some kind of fruit extract and pumped carbon dioxide into it. This tastes like nothing else.
You mentioned that the champagne we're drinking is a non-vintage champagne. Can you explain that designation, vintage and non-vintage?
Sure. So a vintage champagne simply means that all the grapes that you're getting in that bottle were harvested in the same year, and it's a specific year that's written on the bottle. Whereas the non-vintage, it's kind of just a greatest hits. So what you would compare it to is, of course, nothing can compare with listening to Miles Davis doing Kind of Blue or Bitches Brew, you know, in its original context. But if you were to get some CD that was Miles Davis's greatest hits or whatever, you know, it's still Miles, and it's still great.
So the non-vintage champagnes, do they tend to be less expensive?
Yes, they're vastly less expensive. Just for example, so this house, as I say, sells this non-vintage for about $35, $40 a bottle. But their premier line, Cristal, a bottle is about $300. And, you know, a bottle that's been around for a while can cost $1,000, $2,000.
Now, you describe champagne socialism as among the most ennobling and well-intentioned of all political creeds. Could you get into that a little more? Just tell us what exactly your vision is and what are the logistics of it?
Right, sure. So one of the only other socialisms that I support is socialized medicine. But if you want to compare the relative value of the two, like health with drinking, it's obvious that champagne socialism is much more important and a much more urgent need as far as moving America towards being a juster polity. Champagne socialism essentially says people don't just deserve not to die in the street or, you know, to have a roof over their heads or enough calories or whatever for their body to perform its basic functions. Champagne socialism says that at least a little bit of the very best should belong to everyone. And so in that sense, champagne socialism goes hand in hand with having nice architecture and trying to have, you know, great art available to people free of charge in museums and making sure that, you know, children can be acquainted with classical music or read the best literature. The thing is that health is so unimportant at the end of the day because you could just die. But if you did, you know, what you would want to do in the hours beforehand is have some champagne, it's a more urgent and pressing need.
Right. What did Dr. Johnson say? You know, someone commented to him, you know, that giving money to beggars would just lead them to buy drink. And he said, well, if you were impoverished and living in the street, wouldn't you want a little something to make time pass?
Yeah, he spoke for liberty in England when he issued that just rebuke. The poor, like everybody else, deserve alcohol, tobacco, as well as access to medical care and housing and all the other necessities of life.
And I believe Bill de Blasio is going to raise the minimum price of tobacco here in the city yet again. So a lot of people will still be able to afford it. Some people really won't be able to.
Yeah, that's what's so infuriating about de Blasio. Sometimes you see in the conservative press de Blasio referred to as a socialist, but he's actually the opposite. He's some kind of vile Whig who wants to confiscate luxuries from the poor.
Yeah, I've paid $8 for a pack here, though. If you go to the right bodegas, you can get sold things under the counter. There are workarounds.
That's comforting. Now, Matthew, your review touched off a minor controversy, which we feature in the letters section of our June-July issue. Joshua Baggett of Dallas, Texas, argues against champagne snobbery precisely because he agrees with you that the poor should have good things. So he writes that low-end sparkling wines, such as Barefoot Bubbly, which you have denigrated, have done exactly what Walther hopes for. They have made champagne, or something so like it, the difference is a technicality, available to middle and even working class people. Now, what say you?
There's all the difference in the world. It's like saying that, you know, some guy can win the Tour de France, and that's the same thing as my daughter riding her tricycle. They're both going really fast on this thing that has pedals. But I'm afraid, without impugning his character, I just have to say that Mr. Baggett is wrong, which is why it's my understanding the magazine has agreed to send him a bottle for the purpose of enlightenment.
I think he has received it by now, though we haven't received a full report.
It seems necessary to educate the palates of the working class and even the middle class at this point.
Well, yeah, this is probably
the upper class, too.
And the upper class.
This is another important aspect of champagne socialism. All the great socialist thinkers of late 19th century England, like John Ruskin and William Morris, would, you know, go to the working man's college, and they would deliver lectures on Leonardo and things like that, and Milton, you know, because those things shouldn't be beyond the purview of, you know, people who work with their hands for a living. And so it's the same kind of thing. Any kind of program for Champagne socialism has to involve education, voluntary or otherwise.
Very sound. Could you give us your recommendations for a few different occasions? The birth of a child, a lucrative book deal, a papal interregnum, and your stranding on a desert island.
Sure. For the first one, the birth of a child, I can speak from experience and say that because a birth can go on for a long time, and because it's a bit more work for the mother than it is for the father, you'll need a few. And so it's best to go cheap and just get a nice Veuve Clicquot, non-vintage, $30 or something. Maybe get four of those. One to toast when the baby was born, but maybe three to drink while you're pacing up and down the street and chain smoking, waiting for the news. Now, for a lucrative book deal, especially if you're having lunch with your publisher, I think there you want to go with something that introduces just an extra element of joviality. So there I would go with a rosé champagne. The color just seems so celebratory. So I would go with something like maybe the Cristal rosé, which comes in maybe the most gorgeous bottle on the market right now, and make them pick up the $400 tab.
Definitely. Number three is the papal interregnum.
Oh gosh. I don't know that I would want to drink champagne on that occasion. I think I would probably want to stick to gin, in which case anything will do, just Gordon's with some tonic or with tap water or just by itself.
And you're stranding on a desert island?
If I were stranded on a desert island and I only have one bottle, I mean, I think in that case, that's one of these occasions where the mind has to concentrate itself, just as if, you know, I were on a desert island, I would be studying Holy Writ and praying. I would want to go with the quintessential champagne, so I would go for a bottle of Dom Perignon.
Now, what makes Dom Perignon the quintessential champagne?
So this wonderful medieval French monk is often reputed to have been the inventor or discoverer of champagne. Unfortunately, the historical record doesn't really bear that out. It's one of those things like St. George and the Dragon. I don't think it does the faithful any harm to believe it, but it's unlikely to have happened. It's a pious legend, which is fine. That plays a valuable role in champagne socialism. You need your national myths.
But then there are things like Barefoot Bubbly, and that's like a Medjugorje to your Fatima. It's a
right.
Illegitimate.
Yeah.
I don't want to enter into a totally unrelated controversy in case there's any dissent here. But, and I myself haven't looked into those apparitions, but there has to be a certain parsing, at least, of the legitimate and illegitimate parts of the champagne canon, right?
Yes, and this is something that a lot of people get wrong. I couldn't tell you one way or the other whether the European Union is any good for tax policy or banking or any of those other boring subjects, but when it comes to wine, the European Union is the most important force in the world. So, for example, it used to be possible for these sort of unscrupulous winemakers to sell their wine as champagne method, you know, which is kind of like grape drink. It's that sort of thing. But
wine product.
Yeah.
I've also seen this in the convenience stores, wine product.
Yeah. But for quite a while now, it's been illegal in Europe to do that. I wish we had such sane, healthy regulatory authorities in this country, because you'll often, if you go into the supermarket, you can find something called California champagne, you know, which is like Antarctic pizza or something.
Well, a lot of people are leaving. Maybe we can get into the EU, you know, which we'll soon be able to toast.
Speaking of toasting, Let's all drink up, refresh our glasses, and then bring this home.
I'll do it. And I'll pull it here, too. We're near the end of the bottle here.
While pouring out the rest of the champagne, junior fellow Connor Grupa performs a clever substitution involving Mr. Walther's glass. Stand by for the results.
Talk about spark plugs or something. I just feel so inadequate. I don't have a very mechanical kind of technical mind.
So tell us about the fateful year 1994.
1994 was one of the most important years for cultural criticism in recent memory, because that year Harold Bloom wrote this book called The Western Canon, in which he asserted on purely aesthetic grounds the merits of Shakespeare and Cervantes and Jane Austen and all these wonderful writers. And also in that year, another esteemed cultural critic, Biggie Smalls, recorded a paean to Champagne, among other things. And so Champagne, you know, I think it's probably as important, if not more important, to what we think of as Western civilization than some of the things Bloom talks about in his book, because the Canterbury Tales are delightful, but there's also some very dodgy and immoral stuff in there. And it's the same problem with a lot of good books. And cathedrals are wonderful, but you can't really move them around. It's great if you can go see them. Some classical music is nice. Some of it is very boring and technical. But Champagne, of all these things that we think of as crucial to European civilization, you know, is portable and just sort of self-evidently wonderful. At least after we've gone through the Champagne Maoist phase of cultural re-education, everyone will recognize its merits. And sort of the Cultural Revolution, I think, was instigated by Biggie Smalls and carried on by Jay-Z and other connoisseurs since.
Shall we toast Biggie Smalls?
Yes, absolutely. We drink champagne when we're thirsty.
One of these fussy Frenchmen said he didn't like the rappers constantly talking about his champagne brand, whoever it was.
Oh, yeah. It was actually someone involved with Cristal, which was Biggie Smalls' preferred champagne, and that of many other rappers. And Jay-Z responded with a statement, quite rightly, knocking this old tosser for his snobbery and asserting the first principles of champagne socialism, and also suggesting that his friends switch to Dom Perignon, which they probably did.
No barefoot bubbly for him. Out of curiosity,
sure.
Do you have any dissatisfaction with the glass of champagne you're drinking right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little warm.
It's also barefoot bubbly.
Mm-hmm. For real?
Yeah. We pranked you.
I mean, it's a little sweet, a little syrupy.
We were hoping you would do a spit take or something.
Oh. No, it just kind of tasted warm. I mean, we could fake that.
No.
It's fine. No, it just tasted warm, but I thought we should just press on for the purposes of content.
So would you like more barefoot bubbly?
Yeah, sure. So where
the reveal.
Yeah. This is their extra dry model. in the huge one.
It was very cheap. It was $10 or something.
You didn't get the Blanc de Blancs?
No.
They also have one that's
had the rosé as well.
Yeah, but there's one that's in it's turquoise or blueberry.
Wait, really?
And I always walk past it in Target when I'm getting baby food.
Yeah, we went into Buy the Barefoot Bubbly, and we actually initially went to a store that I thought was stocking it, but wasn't. And so we asked the clerk to show us to the Barefoot Bubbly, and he shamed us pretty aggressively, I thought.
Yeah, I prefer to call it discalced. effervescence when I serve it. I think that like accords with the dignity it merits.
Robert Cardinal Seurat has a new book out from Ignatius Press, The Power of Silence, Against the Dictatorship of Noise. That's an interestingly Ratzingerian title from the current prefect of the Congregation for Divine Worship, who some of us hope, please, 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 could be the next pope. Matthew Schmitz has read the book and is enthusiastic about it and its author. Matthew, what does Cardinal Seurat have to say about silence, and why should we listen?
The book is really a compilation of quotes from spiritual masters, and Seurat then puts his own thoughts on silence alongside theirs. I have to say they stack up quite well. Seurat has a public image as some kind of knuckle-dragging, reactionary, maybe an extreme traditionalist. This is ginned up, I think, by certain people who want to tar and stigmatize any kind of Orthodox Catholicism. In fact, you know, as we see in this book, Seurat is, I would call him a moderate bishop in the mold of Ratzinger and JP II. Now, the thesis of the book is this. We live in a time where noise has come to dominate life. There is an incessant repetition of meaningless images, words, usually designed to manipulate us, to make us buy something, to make us vote for a certain candidate. Now, we've heard phrases, the dictatorship of relativism. So Francis might say the globalization of indifference. You know, JP II would say the culture of death. So Catholic bishops have been full of phrases like this. There's something particularly fitting, though, in Seurat's coinage, I think. You know, dictatorship of noise, you know, dictatorship. It's that idea of speech, you know, the dictation. The way that all of these noises are trying to control us. Seurat wants to free us from that worldly domination. And in order to do so, he commends to us the ancient Christian practice of silence. You know, think of Elijah. When we seek God, we don't find him in the storm. We don't find him in the earthquake. We don't find him in the fire. We find him in the silence, in the still small voice. Why is God silent? Well, one reason is surely that he wants to give us freedom. He doesn't want to dictate to us how we live. He doesn't want to manipulate us with an incessant barrage of words. God is not like, say, Coca-Cola or Dove soap. He's not constantly trying to manipulate us into coming closer to him. He gives us freedom to respond to him, and we respond to him in those moments of silence.
In a way, this is a fairly familiar argument. You know, we need to turn off our screens and say some rosaries. I think First Things has published about 100 versions of that argument. But Seurat goes even farther. Even in a presumptively Christian context, he prioritizes silence over speech, so the contemplative life over the evangelistic life.
Well, one of the biggest mistakes that Christians have made in responding to media is to focus too exclusively on content and not enough on the form. So you have things like, you know, parental advisory warnings, things like this, film censorship codes. These things are by no means unimportant, but they don't really exhaust the moral nature of film. Marshall McLuhan, himself a great Catholic thinker, taught us that the medium, at least to an extent, is the message. So what happens when we have, say, Christianity being presented in the form of, you know, tweets, as it now is, the Pope now tweets, or where the, you know, the papacy has effectively become an organ for generating quotes and images. The Pope is constantly traveling. He's appearing before crowds. There are these images that still haunt the Catholic imagination, either as figures of terror or figures of kind of, you know, attractive regression. You know, say the Pope with his three-tiered tiara. But actually the modern papacy, the perils it faces, are not the temptations of monarchical power, right? They're actually the temptations of modern celebrity. So it's the microphone and not the scepter that tempts the Bishop of Rome today to too much take on a worldly form. And Seurat, I think, wants to, he's not speaking directly about the Pope, but he's speaking about every priest, every bishop, and he warns us against a kind of talky church where there's not the profound reflection that leads to productive conversation.
Seurat has this wonderful passage in his book. He says that he will untiringly denounce, essentially, priests who talk too much. And then he writes, "In order to make themselves known or to impose their personal views, both on the theological and the pastoral level, they speak again and again. These clerics repeat the same banal things. I could not affirm that God dwells within them. Who can think their sheer outpourings to be a spring coming from the divine depths? But they talk, and the media love to listen to them in order to re-echo their ineptitudes, particularly if they declare themselves in favor of the new post-humanist ideologies in the realm of sexuality, the family, and marriage." And then he goes on from there. So there's just a very striking, just total exasperation with volume of words. And Seurat connects loquacity very clearly with heterodoxy.
Right, and that has to do with his idea that needless speech is oppressive and manipulative. There's not a contentment with the faith as it's been handed down, but instead an effort to kind of put over a new thing simply by the, you know, oppressive repetition through the media of certain slogans. You know, we've heard of, you know, the Council of the Media as a kind of misinterpretation of the Second Vatican Council. And so, you know, it's a familiar idea in Catholic thought that the media, of which we here at First Things are certainly a part, pose, you know, real threats for distorting the faith. You know, the English ultramontane writer W.G. Ward liked to say he wished he could get a papal bull with his Times at breakfast each morning. That would be wonderful if that were somehow possible. But if you increase the frequency of communication, its profundity will correspondingly decrease. So we do get a papal bull with breakfast each morning. I look at my iPhone and there's usually a tweet there from the Pope. You know, I read that and I find it, you know, totally unobjectionable as a rule, and sometimes I find it delightful. Francis's best tweet was, "The world is more and more becoming an immense pile of filth," which I like to retweet occasionally just as a perennially true observation for anyone who subscribes to a declinist view of things, as I'm tempted to do. But a papal bull it is not.
Cardinal Seurat's interest in silence and noise seems relevant to his current job. He's the prefect of the Congregation for Divine Worship, in other words, head of liturgy. He was appointed to that position by Pope Francis in 2014. What are Cardinal Seurat's views on liturgy insofar as we can divine them?
Cardinal Seurat is obviously extending the Ratzingerian project, the reform of the reform. Now, Francis himself has spoken out against that idea, the reform of the reform, but he's nonetheless put Seurat in place and has yet to remove him, though the calls for his removal are constant. If you read unreadable magazines like the National Catholic Reporter and the Tablet of London, Francis has nonetheless stood behind Seurat, I think because he doesn't want to reignite the liturgy wars. It's not really the focus for him, and so he just hasn't reunited them, though he does seem to disagree with Seurat. Now, what does Seurat actually want? Does he want to bring back the Latin Mass? Does he want to take the ladies with felt banners, the priests who say the Mass wearing turtlenecks, and you know, the liturgical dancers, and ship them off to a very dark and unpleasant place? Sadly, no. As much as I wish that were the case, really, he's just committed the same things Ratzinger did when he was Pope. So he said, you know, we should face toward the Lord who comes to us in the Mass. Ad orientem, the congregation as one faces the Lord. This was a comment of his that he made at a liturgical conference in London last year. And there's a huge amount of outrage when he said we should face east. Now, Pope Benedict XVI had said that many times. So why all of the outrage when Seurat said it? Well, people hope that with Francis, such opinions could go away. And there was also, I think, a political effort to isolate, what is the Alinskyite rule for how to destroy a person?
Well, it's like freeze it, personalize it.
It's like
it.
You polarize.
Personalize, polarize.
Yeah, isolate, personalize, polarize, isolate, I think, right? So try to personalize it, present Seurat as someone who's crazy, polarize. Well, he wants the Latin Mass. I mean, I think that he grew up with it as a young boy. I think doesn't view it as somehow heretical in the way that certain modernists do. But no, he doesn't. He's not trying to bring that back. And so, you know, they wanted to isolate him. Why do they want to do that? I think they're afraid he might be a contender in the next papal conclave. And so they want to put a dent in him.
Seurat seems interested at one point in vindicating public figures who don't speak out a great deal. So he says, keeping quiet has the appearance in this postmodern context of being a weakness, a lack of will. The silent person becomes someone who does not know how to defend himself. The so-called strong man is a man of words. He crushes and drowns others in the flood of his speeches.
One of the things that I think the book implicitly does is argues for the dignity of Pope Benedict's current situation. People, I think, are a bit confused about what's going on in Rome. So we have an emeritus pope, whatever that means, and we have a current pope. We're reassured, including by them, that they both see eye to eye, but there's actually a great deal of conflict happening in the church. What's going on? Well, I think actually the current pontificate is very explicitly and directly opposed to the previous one. This goes back to various disputes held between Cardinal Casper and then Cardinal Ratzinger around 2000. It took place in the pages of America magazine and elsewhere. But effectively, the current pontificate is trying to bury Benedict and undo his work. I think that's the assessment that history will have, however uncomfortable that makes Catholic children right now. And we never like to see our parents fighting. That's the case. Whoever may be right or wrong, that's what's going on.
And then people who are more simpatico with Benedict often want him to speak out.
Right, so people say, you know, this being the case, if there is a strong conflict, why is Benedict not speaking out? Because you basically have Francis and his closest associates putting forward propositions that Ratzinger explicitly repudiated about 20 years ago. Why won't he speak out? Does that, well, you know, I think that passage you read from Seurat does very nicely in explaining the dignity and nobility of Ratzinger's position. Certainly his words are there for everyone to read. You know, it's not a mere struggle for power. If the Catholic faith is true, then, you know, its truth is also connected to holiness. And one of the aspects of holiness is surely a readiness and total humility to accept whatever slanders or whatever falsehoods are put out against you. So you see this, I think, certainly in Benedict's current attitude.
Right.
Where he's being disparaged in many quarters. His own ideas are treated as retrograde and inadmissible, even while he's alive. So this outraged reaction to Seurat's comment about ad orientem, just to take one example, that is an attempt to bury Benedict, to put him underground while he's still living. And I think there's a really resplendent beauty in his silence on these points.
His refusal to speak is a refusal to participate in the dictatorship of noise. And so Seurat's appropriation of that figure, dictatorship of blank, is a kind of homage to Ratzinger.
Yeah, I think that's the case, both in the broad culture and in the church. It's the repetition of slogans. So for example, kind of things that are pastoral,
merciful.
Well, I think, you know, mercy's not a terrible concept, but yeah. No, I mean, as Ratzinger said in his original debate with Casper, there's no word so high or so perfect that it cannot be misused in these debates. And you see that certainly in the way that mercy is understood. Yeah, and so one hopes that, you know, the sloganeering will one day be calmed, and Catholics will receive a clarification, and the Church will begin to act in such a way that the Catholic faith is not just a set of propositions or ideals that are true in some cloudy manner, you know, up in the sky, but that are actually taught and practiced in a really everyday way, so that the Church is concrete and the Incarnation can be experienced and not just professed.
Now, Syrah is from Guinea, formerly French Guinea in West Africa, so he has a French colonial background. What are his views on France and on Europe so far as we can divine them?
I think that we've probably left the age of great reflection on Europe by the popes, at least for the time being. This was something that Ratzinger was able to do, but surely that hasn't been extinguished altogether. There's a kind of romanity in the church, a kind of a way that it encourages its sons to think of the good of the city, to think in a republican manner of the good of the whole world. And you see that in Syrah. It comes really through two conduits. One, I think, just his formation as a member of the Latin Church, and then also from his French colonial education. When he was a young boy in this very remote village in Guinea, he went through the same French curriculum that was taught in Paris and in every French colonial outpost. So he had to recite in his lessons, you know, "I am descended from the Gauls." You see with many colonial contexts that people who are somehow outsiders to a culture are actually able to adopt the culture much more earnestly and even more thoroughly and enthusiastically than an insider ever would.
They're not burdened by the mistakes that culture has made, for one thing.
Yes, exactly. So they don't really feel the burden of guilt from that culture, but they do see its allure. They want access to it. And so I think often these somewhat kind of marginal or colonial figures will actually end up defending the culture more vigorously than anyone else. I think you saw that in the way Syrah reacted to the murder of Jacques Hamel. He spoke out very strongly against this Islamist terrorism. And I think from most of the Catholic bishops of Europe and from Pope Francis himself, there was a much greater eagerness to not present this as a war over Europe or a war over religion. They wanted to avoid the mistakes of the past, the stigmatization of the other. And so there's a totally different way of speaking, I think, probably connecting to these different experiences.
Syrah tweeted in response to the murder of Jacques Hamel. He said this in French, but basically, how many deaths does it take, how many severed heads, for European leaders to understand the situation the West is in? So you have a colonial speaking to what is good for the West, a colonial speaking to what is good for the French. France should be French. It doesn't need to keep absorbing all these sort of foreign agents, which is a very interesting thing for a French colonial to say, but also, as you outline, in a certain way, a very consistent thing for him to say.
Right. So, I mean, in a way, Syrah almost has the voice of the last European. You know, just biographically, personally, we can, be assured that he's not trying to support some narrow, racially exclusionary idea of what Europe or France or anything else might be, but he's instead trying to speak out strongly for its positive values.
Final question, is Cardinal Syrah papabile?
Is he popable? I don't have a crystal ball. I think that, when one's looking for a pope, one seeks someone who's able to defend and explicate Catholic doctrine, a man who has abilities to lead an organization, and also a man who has a profound interior and spiritual life. And those are all qualities that Syrah preeminently possesses. He probably combines them in a way that is as impressive as any other cardinal in the Catholic Church. Will Syrah be the next pope? I don't know. I think in looking for the next pope, the cardinals will probably want to look for a man who resembles Syrah in every way. Whether or not they actually pick him, this is, of course, up to them. One hopes with the assistance of a higher power. Pius XIII. So if Syrah is elected pope, I hope he takes one of two names. First, the first possibility, Pius XIII. Now, I was hoping for this even before HBO came out with a series suggesting Pius XIII. What they got wrong was picking an Italian ethnic from America and not a fearless black bishop from Africa. That's what they should have done. But if he doesn't take the name Pius XIII, that's fine. I'd also be very happy with Francis II.
If you'd like to know more about the champagne we drank on this episode, visit your local wine and spirits joint and ask for a Louis Roederer non-vintage. If you'd like to know more about Robert Cardinal Syrah, visit firstthings.com, where we recently published an essay titled, "With Cardinal Syrah, the Liturgy is in Good Hands," by the one and only Benedict XVI. In it, the mostly silent Pope Emeritus makes clear that Syrah is a man after his own heart. The essay was written as an afterword for a future reprinting of The Power of Silence, and we have it for you exclusively at firstthings.com. That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to Matthew Walther for educating our palates, and for being so polite about the barefoot bubbly prank. Thanks to my colleagues, Matthew Schmitz and Connor Grubaugh. And thank you, listeners.
This is quite delicious.
How does it stack up to your preferred drink, Diet Coke?
Well, it's it has less of that nutmeggy flavor that I really appreciate in Diet Coke, and the carbonation is a little subtler in the champagne, but I enjoy this too. Diet Coke for all is my mantra.
As a non-vintage, certainly. On the other hand, if you were to compare it to the fine Diet Cokes of 97,
right?
You know, with
that was the Comet year, right?
Yeah.